From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Metro Detroit flooding raises new questions about our sewer and storm drainage systems.
Next time you're driving around, go look out at a big parking lot and think, when it rains, that rain can't go into that concrete.
Why beef up a small West Michigan town's police force, including military gear from Uncle Sam?
Where do you go when your Humvee breaks down or your armored military personnel carrier breaks down? And who trains these people to use these things? I mean, these are not toys.
And could the state open up Hartwick pines to underground drilling?
These are pine that are up to 400 years old. They're up to 12 feet in circumference. They're up to 165 feet tall. This is what Michigan looked like before logging.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Controversy is springing up in the close-knit community of Berry Township in West Michigan. This comes after allegations of harassment from local police. The department consists of four full-time officers, four part-time officers, and almost three dozen non-credited reserve officers. The small town also boasts two Humvees and two armored personnel carriers. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why beef up a small West Michigan town's police force, including this military gear from Uncle Sam? But first, we may not be able to prevent an extreme weather event like the monster rainfall that socked Metro Detroit last week. But what should cities, towns, and counties be doing to prepare for future severe weather? Crane's Detroit Business Lansing reporter Chris Gouts has been checking in with folks in the know about what can be done. And one answer, Chris, appears to be green infrastructure.
Yeah, this is what we keep hearing about. Every time I would call somebody, they would bring up this idea. In green infrastructure, it's not at all about things that you would typically associate with green and infrastructure, like solar panels and windmills and things like that, because you don't think about those connecting with storm drains. But in this case, what green infrastructure is talking about is using sustainable methods to keep the water from ever getting to those storm drains. And so there's all sorts of different ways, and a lot of communities are using these methods and actually requiring businesses and new construction to have systems in place that don't have any runoff to go into their storm drain. So they're really trying to manage it from that end. Ann Arbor is a community where they actually have a stormwater fee where they charge by the amount of impervious surface that you have on your property, because stormwater is a service that a city provides, even though we don't think about it in that way. So some of the ways businesses are getting around that is they're using things like pervious concrete. And it's not something that's terribly common, but you may have seen it and just not known what it was. It kind of looks like a Rice Krispie treat that you'll see in a sidewalk or the edge of a driveway. And so when the water runs down it, it allows the water to go through it, and then it can filter down into the system and drain naturally. Or some companies will even go so far as to have it drain right into a well that they then use to recycle that water and use it for their sprinkler systems. They also talk about having green roofs or rain gardens, things like that, that use that water instead of having it just go into the drain.
You point out in your piece in Cranes, and you just kind of alluded to this, that the inherent weakness of our current storm system is it all dates back to an era when there was so much less ground covered by concrete.
Yeah, I mean, that was the way that planners and engineers sort of designed our buildings and our parking lots, was that the idea was that you wanted to get the rain off of parking lots and off of flat surfaces as quickly as possible. And so they just, tilted them down and made them, forced them down into the drain so that we didn't have to see the water. Well, that's not the way to do it anymore, because as we've seen, the rise of, big mega malls and huge parking lots. And so it was one of the people I talked with said, next time you're driving around, go look out at a big parking lot and think, when it rains, that rain can't go into that concrete. It's got to go somewhere, and it's going into your basements, like in this flood that we just experienced. And so that's what they're talking about. And so when you see little patches of green inside of a parking lot, flower beds or rain gardens, those are the kind of things they're talking about, because all that water has to go somewhere, and they really don't want it going into the drain. And so it's not just about having the newest and biggest pipes. It's about finding ways to keep that water on your own property and use it again, rather than sending it out for everyone to have it go into their system.
Chris, you pointed in your piece for Cranes to a 2001 report. So that was back over 10 years ago from SEMCOG, that at that time said it would be between $14 billion and $26 billion that it would cost by 2030 to maintain and improve Southeast Michigan's sewer infrastructure. Well, boy, now we're looking at 40-year-old sewer infrastructure, and I've got to imagine, good luck coming up with that kind of money to fix sewers when we can't even fix the road damage we're driving on from last winter.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely right. And I don't know if you could double those dollar amounts from 2001, but they're definitely going to be much higher. And when I talk with folks, I felt a little weird about including a study from 2001 in this story, but everyone I talked to said, those numbers are still right on because we just don't have the money in place. You know, the state and the federal government are taking money out of local governments. And so all this stuff hasn't gotten fixed. And so when they said, you know, 60 to 70% of the region's sewer systems are more than 30 years old, now they're more than 40, 45 years old. And so that's still a big problem. There's just not the money to fix this stuff.
And we have heard from climate scientists that there will be more episodes like this, that we can expect severe weather as the climate changes. That's a fact. So it sounds like it doesn't do anybody any favors when you hear people say, well, this was the kind, you know, no system could have kept up with the kind of rain that we had. Doesn't that kind of pass the buck or kind of gloss over the deeper problem of what are we going to do for the future?
Yeah, a little bit. And so that was sort of the problem, is that everyone was saying that this was an act of God storm or a 300-year storm. And so that was part of the problem. So even if we would have had brand new pipes, all brand new infrastructure, we still would have had some of this flooding. And so, yeah, so you could probably, some people will look at that and say, well, I guess we don't need to, you know, do so much. This was just a really, you know, horrendous storm that nobody could have prepared for. But the problem is that storm put a ton of pressure on this very old system. And so if there's another one or in the one after that, you know, these pipes are getting older and the system is getting older, and you keep putting that much pressure on it, and eventually something could break and it could make the flooding even worse. And so that seems to be the impetus now, is to say we've got to get a hold on this, because like you said, these things are happening much more often. And one of the things that's starting to get talked about now among climatologists and even some officials at the state and at the national level is looking at, are our definitions of a 10-year storm event, of a 50-year, 100-year storm event, do we need to rethink those? Do we need to redefine those? Because these storms are happening at a much more frequent rate. And so should we look at, is a 10-year storm event, which is what we build a lot of our systems to, should we build that to a different level? And should be, because we're seeing so many more, much more frequent large storms. The problem with that is that that could come with standards that all municipalities would have to raise to build even bigger systems. And we can't even, you know, fully build to and protect the systems that we have now. And so it would just add even more, you know, money to the total cost.
It means time and money. And those are things government is not always so good at.
that's very true, among other things.
Chris Gouts, Crane's Detroit Business Lansing reporter. As always, thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Are you afraid of crime? Even more, are your kids scared of crime? If your answer is yes, my next guest says that is not a bad thing. Chris Melde is an associate professor of criminal justice at Michigan State University. His study on our fear of crime has been published in the journal Justice Quarterly. Chris, why can fear of crime be good, especially for kids?
Fear of crime is really kind of our natural instincts to remain vigilant in the face of potential danger. And so if adolescents have a healthy fear of crime, it's really an indication that they are likely to take precautionary behaviors in situations or potentially avoid situations that are inherently dangerous.
Situations such as?
You know, some of the situations that we studied in our study specifically would be things like going to parties where drugs and alcohol are available, hanging out where there's no adult supervision, or hanging out with delinquent peers, which are known risk factors for violent victimization as well as violent offending on their own part.
Interesting. Your study find really there's a victim-offender overlap, isn't there? Tell us a little more about that.
Absolutely. What research has consistently found over the last few decades is that the population most at risk for being violently victimized are the same folks who are most likely to victimize other people. So offenders are at particularly high a risk of being victimized themselves. And there's actually research that suggests that youth who are victimized early on and are violently victimized are also more prone to go on and victimize others. And so there's a hefty overlap in those populations. That's not to say that they're not pure victims out there in that sense that there's people who are victimized who aren't also offenders, but there's just a high overlap in that victim-offender pool.
I would bet, and tell me if I'm wrong and I'm on the wrong track here, that the fear of crime that most of us think of is exactly that of the pure victim, somebody that is you know, if you say a total innocent victim, not involved in any way, shape, or form, and somehow becomes, you know, a crime statistic. Is that kind of behind our fear?
Absolutely. When people think of, you know, people being fearful of crime, you know, they think of the elderly who might be shut in their homes, or in particular females who are afraid of being victimized, and so they kind of avoid all social interactions. And that's not really what we're talking about here. We're really talking about a kind of a continuum of people's anxieties about being victimized. And so what our study is finding is that there's a healthy range. There certainly are people who have more almost phobic levels of fear of victimization, and that's not healthy. But the great majority of people don't have that high of fear. And what we actually find is that people with a really low level of fear are actually more likely to put themselves in harm's way and have a higher rate of victimization. So I think the way to think about fear of crime is more on a continuum, where there's, you know, unhealthy amounts of fear on the high end and unhealthy amounts of fear on the low end. It's not just that people are either fearful or not fearful.
Interesting. Chris, what are your thoughts on how we should be balancing the need to talk about crime and report on crime and the fear that can come from that, and then overplaying crime, creating too much fear, if you will. Sometimes we'll hear complaints that media coverage of crime, let's say on cable networks, has actually made us think crime is worse than what it really is. What's the happy medium?
I think one of the things that we kind of took off this study was that an accurate portrayal of crime is really what's necessary. And so there's a lot of thought that has gone into how do we report crime in a more responsible way, or how do police departments communicate crime in a more responsible way. And so there's been steps taken to either put the risks of victimization in perspective, or to highlight places more on a geographical basis of where crimes are most likely to occur.
Michigan State criminologist Chris Meldy, whose study on fear of crime was published online in the journal Justice Quarterly. Thanks for talking with us today, Chris.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Our insatiable need for energy could be colliding with our desire to preserve Michigan's natural beauty. Case in point, some 9,700 acres of Hartwick Pine State Park near Grayling could be included this fall in a DNR auction for a lease of mineral rights. Exactly what is that? What could it mean for the Lower Peninsula's largest stand of old-growth white pines, some more than 400 years old? Ron French is here. He reported on this story for Bridge Magazine. Ron, what is this auction about?
Twice a year, the Department of Natural Resources holds auctions where they lease oil and gas rights for anyone who wants to actually explore and try to extract minerals. And it's what we found surprising is it's not unusual for the state to actually lease ground underneath the state parks. This has happened several places around the state. And what makes this such an issue is because Hartwick Pines is such a treasure for the state.
It is a sacred area, I think, to so many people who love Michigan's outdoors. How did Hartwick Pines become a player in this?
Companies or individuals can nominate any state property for oil and gas exploration. And there was a client of a Michigan oil and gas company that said, we'd like to explore there, at least wanted to nominate it, is what they call it. They nominate parcels of land for bid at an auction where they will bid on this property. And if they get it, then they have a 5 years where they can decide if they want to actually explore underneath the ground there.
Now, a lease doesn't give them automatically the right to drill, does it?
No, it does not. That's a very good point. They would still have to go to the Department of Environmental Quality and then try to get a lease. And actually, of property that is leased, only about 10% of it is ever developed. So what are the chances of something actually going on near Hartwick Pines? They're small, but they're greater than would be if this lease hadn't occurred.
And what could that something be? What? Let's just take it out to the—
Absolutely.
It happens, you know, the lease is up, it happens, and somebody starts doing this drilling. What would that be?
Right. What is important for people to know is you're not going to see an oil well built right next to this 400-year-old white pine.
Oh, that's comforting, I guess.
But
that's something, but
that's something that when you see these headlines that people worry about. what they're leasing is the mineral rights underneath that ground. And so what could happen if this were to come to happen is that there could be slant drilling or horizontal drilling starting off park land, that a company could lease parcels off the park land and then drill underneath the park to try to get to oil underneath it.
How far down do they go?
It could be anywhere from 1 to 2 miles down. So you look at that and you say, is that really going to affect a tree that has roots nowhere near a mile deep? And so environmentally, as far as these trees are concerned, it's very, very unlikely that this sort of thing could damage them in any way. Now, there is more of a possibility that it could damage our enjoyment of those trees.
How so?
Well, because these oil wells, these oil drilling rigs could be just off property, the park lands. You could hear them. They could increase traffic as equipment is going in and out. So it's really a question, maybe not so much of will these trees be damaged, but could it damage our enjoyment of this just precious state park? And is there a symbolic matter here that we should be taking in consideration too?
Let's get into that, because there have to be sides lining up on either side of this symbolic question.
Absolutely. We're seeing just a huge amount of debate on this now. And it's lining up where a lot of people are saying, the only people complaining about this are people who don't want any drilling anyplace. You've got other people saying that this is a sacred place. You should keep your hands off it. Even if there is no damage done, Michigan is known as pure Michigan. Isn't that our calling card? And are there some places that we should keep off limits for oil leasing just because it symbolically doesn't look good? Do you want to lease the ground under the Statue of Liberty because there might be oil there, even if it's not going to do any damage? Or is it something to say, you know, we've got plenty of other land. Maybe we should just explore other places.
And Hartwick Pines, let's talk a little about that park. It is kind of on a pedestal above so many others for so many reasons.
Right. First, it's a beautiful park, and there are four lakes there. It's a beautiful, wonderful logging museum. If you've never been there, you should go to it, which really ties into this in a lot of ways. But the key of that whole park is this 49-acre parcel that includes really the largest and possibly last stand of white pine, virgin white pine, in the Lower Peninsula. These are pine that are up to 400 years old. They're up to 12 feet in circumference. They're up to 165 feet tall. This is what Michigan looked like 150 years ago.
Before logging.
Before the last thing that came through and took everything out of the state. And for some strange circumstances, this little parcel was left. Now you've got this 49 acres here with these trees. And so even if this lease can actually do no damage to them, I think a lot of people are looking to say, look, these are trees that were 250 years old when all their brothers and sisters were taken out. Okay, mm-hmm. So should we go ahead and protect them and at least symbolically make sure that it doesn't look like we're trying to do any damage to them?
Now, is the public able to file any comments, pro and con, on this right now, or will that come down the road? What do we watch for?
They absolutely can. The Department of Natural Resources is in the midst of its public comment period right now. Unfortunately, they do not take email comments. You have to send an actual old-fashioned letter. That address is available on the Department of Natural Resources site, and more specifically, you can go to Bridge Magazine site, bridgemi.com, and there will be an address there where you can send comments either direction on this.
And October 29th is when the auction happens for these lease rights.
Right, and we'll know a little bit before then whether the state has pulled these parcels off. And frankly, if it's going to be pulled off, it's going to be because of public comment.
So if anyone listening finds this an abhorrent thought, it's time to speak out. Or if someone thinks, no, we should allow it, it's time to speak out and let the DNR know.
And it makes a lot of sense both ways, Cindy, because mm-hmm. it really is doing no damage. And if someone leases land off the park and drills a hole and sucks that oil out from underneath the state's park, the state gets no money for it. That's the other side of the argument here. Lease the land so at least the state will get some money for it if there is oil under there and someone takes it. But is there a symbolic thing here that we need to take into consideration.
Ron French's story at bridgemi.com is oil lease proposed under 400-year-old virgin pines. Always good to talk with you, Ron. Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
And now, a story of failure from Failure Lab Detroit.
My failure. My failure.
My divorce.
I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
Here's Diana Seeger.
I'm known as generally a nervous person. In the morning, before I go to work, I check to make sure that the stove is off, that the toaster is unplugged, that the coffee pot is off. When I back my car out of the garage in the morning, I really check to make sure that I actually did close that garage door. I've been known to get halfway to work and turn right around to make sure that that garage door was shut. Now, I've been accused of being a little OCD. I just think I'm being careful. This is a story about self-protection, about being safe and secure, self-preservation. I want you all to know that I was born and raised here in Detroit. And being a Detroiter means that you're strong, that you're resilient, that you are self-reliant, you've got a bit of grit. And I have been accused of being a tad defiant. I grew up in my formative years in the 60s, where there was tumultuous change, tremendous social change, particularly here in Detroit. That had a tremendous impact on me. On July 21st, 1973, I married my college sweetheart, who was from Grand Rapids. Subsequently got divorced several years later from that man, but I stayed in Grand Rapids just to kind of make him mad. So I moved to Grand Rapids, and we moved into a brand new apartment complex, settled in. You know, was really going well. Well, the way I learned about Grand Rapids was to tape a map of the city on the dashboard of my car. For those of you who use GPS, maps are those things and paper things. And I used that to drive around to every school district office in the greater Grand Rapids area to try to find a teaching job. But you have to understand something. In 1973, there was a teacher glut. So it could be said that I started a little late the beginning of August in the midst of a teacher glut to try to find a teaching position. Oh, well. So imagine my surprise in the middle of September. I received a call from a superintendent of a school district who offered me a job. And the job was to be a substitute for a woman for a teacher who was having a baby and she was taking leave. I got a teaching job in the middle of the teacher glut. Amazing. Well, all that changed on September 25th. In the morning of that day, I went to Meijer, a Grand Rapids-based company. I went to Meijer and bought a lot of groceries. Now, I don't remember why I bought a lot of groceries. Perhaps we were having a party, but that little factoid has escaped me. So I had a lot of bags of groceries in the trunk of my car. So I grabbed two bags and started up the stairs to our third floor apartment. And I was passing the second floor landing. The guy who lived below us was sitting on the stairs, and he was fiddling around with a serrated fishing knife. Didn't think anything of it. I know I said a few words of greeting to him. I don't remember what I said. But I do remember that he didn't acknowledge me. So all the way up, I went to the third floor, dropped those bags of groceries on the counter, came back down, trundled down those stairs, got two more bags of groceries. And as I passed the man on the stairs. He was still there. I walked up and by the landing right below our apartment, I felt this violent shove on my back. Well, the bags of groceries came out of my hands, spewed all over that landing, and I turned around and I realized that this man was stabbing me. Tried to get away. I just wanted to get away, but I couldn't. And we tumbled down a flight of stairs together to the next landing below. Concrete stairs at that. And he was on top of me, repeatedly stabbing me. I just wanted him to stop hurting me. So I was screaming, and that got him more agitated, and he said, "Just be quiet." And his mouth was open, and I took my hand and I dug my fingernails into the bottom of his mouth. A woman who lived on the first floor came out of her apartment to see what all the commotion was all about. And she looked up the stairs and she saw what it was all about and she started wailing. The guy stood up and said to me, "I'm sorry." Walked off in the other direction and went out the apartment building. I crawled down the stairs, went across the parking lot, found a small patch of grass to lay down, collapse on, and in the distance I could hear the sirens of help coming toward me. The EMTs arrived and really started to aggressively work on me. I looked up in the eyes of one of the EMTs and I said, am I going to die? He was very kind, but he answered honestly. And he said, "I don't know." Several days later, as I was recovering in the hospital, those EMTs came to visit me, and I was ever so grateful to see those men who really, really saved my life. Well, after weeks of being in the hospital, two surgeries, I did recover. I'm sure that my young age at the time helped in that. I'm told I missed a beautiful fall season, the events that were unfolding in the Watergate scandal, and I missed my teaching job. Several months later, the trial arrived, and it was excruciating. I had to face my attacker, and I had to tell my story, which telling it back then was really raw and really difficult. The judgment came down that day that this guy was innocent by reason of insanity. And while I'm a little fuzzy on these details, I believe that in that era, that was one of the last times that judgment was made, but I believe it is back again. My family and friends surrounded me, and we walked out of the courtroom. And out of the corner of my eye, I could see my attacker's mother and father coming toward us. And I just said, "I can't do this. I just can't do this." And turned around along with the entire entourage, and we went out another exit. Several weeks later, I was eating dinner with my then husband, and the phone rang. I answered the phone, and I could hear a man sobbing on the other end. It was the father. And he said, as he was choking back the tears, "We are so sorry about what happened, about what our son did to you. We really want to help you. We really want to help cover some of the medical expenses." And all I could do was whisper into the phone, "No, no." And I handed the phone to my husband. He abruptly said to the father, "We don't want your help. Don't ever contact us again." My failure was not giving that mother and father the chance to have closure and healing that they so desperately needed. I have held this for 40 years. I was too young, too immature, and too inexperienced. I'm sure it took that dad hours and days and weeks to gather the strength to to make that telephone call. He was just seeking closure for what his son had done. So just like that garage door in the morning, where I close it and double check it to make sure that everything is safe and secure, I was unable to open that door to that father because I needed to feel safe.
That was Diana Seeger telling her story of failure. You can find out more about Failure Lab and hear more stories at failure-lab.com. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Barry Township is nestled in a quiet corner of West Michigan. It's kind of the midpoint in a triangle formed by Kalamazoo, Battle Creek, and Grand Rapids. Population, about 3,400. But controversy has hit the small town over its police force, specifically the nearly three dozen unpaid reserve police officers, non-certified officers carrying guns, riding in patrol cars, and, according to some in the town, using way too much force. Detroit Free Press reporter Lori Brazier is with us. She's been covering this story. Lori, what was happening that led people in Barry Township to think the police were overdoing it? Examples?
Well, there had been this kind of gradual buildup of the police force. You know, they have four full-time police officers and four part-time police officers who are all certified, and they carry guns. The police chief there became more and more concerned, particularly after Sandy Hook, that he wasn't adequately staffed. So he started recruiting these reserve officers from outside the community. They're unpaid. They're not trained by police academies. He put them in uniform. He gave them guns. He put them in cars, sometimes with certified officers, sometimes, you know, with just reserve officers. And you started to see sort of this escalation of arrests and police stops. And so it was already headed for trouble.
Give us an example or two of the kinds of stops that were alarming people or arrests.
These officers were stopping people for having things dangling off their rearview mirrors. They were stopping a lot of high school kids just to stop them. We had reports where during the snowstorms they would knock on doors and say, you can't have your car parked out there. And then the homeowner would say, well, let me move the car. And the officer would say, well, it's too late. It's going to be towed. You know, you've already lost the opportunity to move the car. So people were getting more and more angry over these tickets and these stops. And then, of course, it escalated with this confrontation between a very well-known, well-liked tavern owner there in May. That's kind of was the tipping point.
And tell us about that.
This is a man who's owned this tavern. It's called Two Jacks Tavern. He's owned it for 30 years. His father owned it with him. And he's well-loved in the community. He does these, you know, food drives for the church, and he's the guy you go to if you need a loan to make the rent. I mean, he's on the planning commission. And he was celebrating his 58th birthday back in May, and he had been out drinking with his friends. The bar was locked up, so it's like 3:30 in the morning. It's very dark. He went to urinate in the back parking lot in the corner, and these three police officers show up in two patrol cars. Two of them are reserve officers, and one of them is a certified officer. In the course of this altercation, they hit him with a police baton and broke some bones in his hands. This is all documented. And he ended up on the ground. He had bloody knees. They kneed him in the back, and he ended up being charged with assault and disorderly conduct. Resisting arrest is the actual term. So it's a 2-year felony. And when word got out that this had happened to this man who doesn't have a criminal history and is, you know, sort of a community leader, that's when people got really angry.
Mm. And on top of these nearly three dozen non-certified reserve officers, you write in your story that this tiny town also has two Humvees and two armored personnel carriers. Where did those come from?
They came from the Department of Defense. The community didn't have to pay for them. They were surplus vehicles from Iraq and Afghanistan. We were not able to see them. The police chief knew by the time we showed up in town that those were a matter of controversy, so he would not allow us to see them. But he said that they were something that they needed. He said that the Humvees were used in the wintertime to rescue folks who got stranded in the snow, and that the armored personnel carriers would be something they would use in the event of a barricaded gunman. We can't find any evidence of there ever having been a barricaded gunman in Delton or Barry Township. I mean, they have a very low crime rate.
And that's what I kind of wondered. What kind of crime was happening in that area that led the chief to decide we need four part-time officers, nearly three dozen gun-carrying reserve officers, two Humvees, two armored personnel carriers?
We actually pulled the crime stats from the Michigan State Police for the year 2013, and we could find absolutely no violent crime in Barry Township at all. There were no assaults. There were no rapes. There were no murders. The only thing we could find, we found, I think, about 15 crimes total that were reported to the Michigan State Police as required by law, and that was a couple of larcenies into vehicles and then also some burglaries in unoccupied homes. So this is not a hotbed of crime.
Well, Lori, how did people in Barry Township, how did they line up on this issue?
We found kind of an interesting demographic. The older folks, and there's a lot of older people there, they have a lot of fear about drug use and people coming in from the larger cities, and so they sort of welcomed this. It was like, you know, the world is changing, and this man can keep us safe, and we would rather have 40 police officers than four. But a lot of the business people and the younger folks and some of the parents who were dealing with, you know, their kids getting stopped, they, after the incident at the tavern, that people had finally just said, we've had enough. They were circulating petitions. They were filling the auditorium at the high school with, you know, the meetings because they couldn't hold them in the township halls anymore because there were too many people who wanted to speak. So it was a very divided community. And that was kind of hard to see because it's a little bit painful to see because it's Delton in particular is a very close-knit community. Everybody knows everybody. They have, you know, churches and school events, and all of a sudden everybody's lined up against each other. So that kind of was an interesting aspect of the story as well.
And Police Chief Victor Pierce ultimately has resigned over this. How was that received?
I actually did not attend the meeting, but from what the reporters at Battle Creek, one of our sister newspapers, said, there was some applause. There were some people who were angry. He left without speaking. Some folks told us he was heckled in the parking lot. You know, you either loved him or hated him in this community, and you know, he's gone, and they're going to start looking for a new police chief, and we'll see what new direction they go.
And what's the status for the reserves right now? Are they still out there with their guns and riding in cars?
No. In fact, before the chief resigned, a couple weeks before, the insurance company that oversees the township's police department said, hey, these guys aren't trained. You can't have them out doing regular police work. You know, we're not going to insure you unless you take care of this. So the program had been temporarily suspended while they were looking to figure out if they could get them certified and how best to train them. But the insurance company was pretty adamant that this posed some liability for the township.
And you actually talked to criminology experts. What do they say about fattening police ranks with these non-certified reserve officers?
They say it's happening all over the country, and it's a post 9/11 phenomena. And then you get, you know, horrific school shootings, rare but still horrific, and that speaks to a level of fear that people have. So it's something that you're seeing. But the problem with it, and this was particularly what we found in Barry Township, these people were outsiders that they were bringing in. So these are unpaid people driving from Battle Creek or Kalamazoo to spend, you know, 9 hours in a police car. They're not being paid. They don't know the people. They don't know the issues. They don't know the community. So you've moved away from the community policing that tends to work. If you know the people that you're interacting with, people, your kids go to school with their kids, you know the history, you don't see the kind of episode that you see that happened in the back of that, you know, dark parking lot. I don't think if it was a police officer who knew this man that it would have ended the way that it did.
And as you pointed out, as you spoke to a criminology professor in New York who was a retired Boston police lieutenant, and I was struck with what he said to you, that it could be dangerous. The last thing you want is a reserve officer in maybe a barricaded gunman situation.
Sure. We actually spoke to a woman. We ended up not quoting her, but she runs a beauty salon in downtown Delton. And three officers came running down the street one day in June, I believe, with their guns drawn. which she'd never seen in her life. I mean, her kids walk up and down that little street, and apparently they thought that there had possibly been a break-in at a grocery store. But, you know, she was just shocked and upset about it. She said, this isn't the kind of town that this is.
What kind of thoughts were you getting from experts and from citizens, this beefing up and this militarization of a small-town police force? What does it say to us, not just in Berry Township, but across the state and across the country? Because we know that Homeland Security is handing out these Humvees and these armored personnel carriers. There's this general kind of militarization. What are we saying about that?
I came away thinking that I think if people are paying attention, they're going to start to realize that this is unnecessary, that these things are not going to keep us safe. You know, one of the things, one of the experts said to us, a Humvee and an armored personnel carrier is not going to save anybody from a mass shooting. You could have somebody walk into a McDonald's, God knows, God help us all, in some rural, you know, city or village in Michigan. The Humvee's not going to save you. The certified or non-certified police officers aren't going to save you. Those things that we're most afraid of are not going to be resolved by beefing up and providing small, even large, police agencies with you know, very expensive military equipment to maintain. That was the other issue. Where do you go when your Humvee breaks down or your armored military personnel carrier breaks down? And who trains these people to use these things? I mean, these are not toys. So there's all kinds of issues above and beyond the safety issue. I think we're going to see a situation sometime soon where people say, okay, enough is enough, and let's get back to knowing who the police officers are in our communities and arming them appropriately with the kind of equipment that they need to keep everybody safe.
Detroit Free Press reporter Lori Brazier, thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing that story that you covered with us.
Thank you.
Michigan's Grape and Wine Industry Council recognized 8 Michigan wines as best in class at their recent awards ceremony. Here to fill us in on the winners is Linda Jones. She's executive director of the council. Hi, Linda.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
What made these 8 in particular stand out?
Well, these 8 were recognized by the judges as being very exemplary in their style for the wines that the winemakers were producing here. And among the winners, the 8 trophy winners, we did have 3 Rieslings, and I know you're a big fan of Rieslings.
I am.
What these Rieslings really demonstrate beautifully is the range of styles that can be made with high quality in Riesling. Riesling is our most widely planted grape in Michigan. And Riesling can be produced in a number of different styles. It can be made into sparkling wine. It can be made in a dry style, a semi-dry style, a dessert wine, and even ice wine. So a full range of sweetnesses. So people who have a particular sweetness palate can find a Riesling to suit them anywhere in Michigan.
And what were some of the other best-in-class winners?
For sparkling wine, we're very well known for sparkling wine because of our cool climate. And the winner there was the Aurora Cellars 2011 Brut. And that's a new winery up in the Leelanau Peninsula.
All right. So we've got 3 Rieslings. We have a sparkling wine.
Our best dry red this year was a repeat from the previous year, Peninsula Cellars 2012 Cabernet Franc. And this is the second consecutive year that this winery has won for this variety. It was a different vintage that won last year, but this has happened a couple of times where a winery has taken a top trophy for 2 consecutive years, and that's quite an accomplishment.
And the last
3? Semi-dry red was Lawton Ridge from the Kalamazoo area. They have a lovely blended red wine called AZO Red, and the name of that is after the call letters for the Kalamazoo Airport. So it's got kind of a flight theme to it. So that's a nice semi-dry red, easy drinking red. In the fruit category, we had a very interesting peach Cremant from 45 North Vineyard and Winery up in the Leelanau Peninsula. And that's a lovely, light, sparkling wine that has some peach flavor, peach juice added to it to give it that lovely peach flavor.
I have to tell you, Linda, we're all sitting around going, yeah, we want to try that. You can see
that
the faces here.
That is a lovely one. Really a nice summer sipping wine for sure. Mm-hmm. And then the best rosé was from Chateau de Leelanau, the 2013 Cabernet Franc rosé. And we do a lot of rosés in Michigan, and they're really got quite a following all around the country. They can be made in a very dry style or a very sweet style. This one is a fairly dry wine and made from Cabernet Franc grapes that we normally associate with a very heavy, full-bodied red wine. So a really interesting collection of trophy winners selected from among the 50 gold medal winners that were awarded during the competition.
Linda, what do the judges take into consideration? What are they looking for?
Sure, they're looking for wines that are true to the character of that particular grape produced in this particular region. So they have in their mind the ideal Cabernet Franc from Michigan, and they are evaluating each wine as it's presented to them as to whether a particular wine deserves a gold, a silver, or a bronze medal. So they look at the wine. It's partly the appearance of the wine. The nose and bouquet are very important. They sniff the wine. And often they can tell a lot about the wine from the aroma. Sometimes some off odors can indicate a problem in the fermentation, and so they'll often pick that up when they smell the wine. And then lastly, they do put it in their mouth and evaluate the flavors, how it interacts with their palate. They are looking for viscosity that is typical of the wine that they're judging, and the mouthfeel. And then usually they almost always spit those wines out into a little bucket and then give their evaluation. They don't need to swallow them. And when you're tasting 75 wines in the day,
yeah,
you don't really want to swallow them. So
no, you want to be able to have a coherent verdict at the end of the 75 wines as you might at the very
right.
beginning and be able to drive home again. I imagine, Linda, that much of this has to do with weather and with growing conditions. So a certain grape that is just fabulous this year, maybe not so much next year.
That's absolutely true, and especially this year after the harsh winter we've had, you know, we're going to have some interesting grapes coming out of the 2014 harvest, but we haven't had a chance to harvest and make wine from those yet. But what's really interesting in our competition now as the industry matures is we're getting several vintages of the same variety. So in the dry red category, we had some 2011 reds, some 2012 reds, and some 2013. No, we didn't have any 2013 reds. Those won't be released till next spring. But the judges were able to see some vintage differences between those two growing years. So it's kind of interesting now that we've got an evolving industry that's reached this level of maturity that the wineries have enough inventory of some of these older wines that they're able to hold them and carry them. And for the dry reds, a little bit of age on them usually is beneficial for them, so that's a good thing.
Well, thanks for filling us in and getting us in the mood for a wonderful glass of wine. Thanks so much, Linda Jones, who is the Executive Director of Michigan's Grape and Wine Industry Council.
Thank you.
Stateside was directed today by Allie Billings. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.